Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. I am your host, Callie Fell. Today on the show, you get to hear from Pamela Garfield-Gager, a licensed clinical social worker with over 20 years of experience. I actually had the pleasure of meeting Pamela at the premiere of our new documentary film titled The Detransition Diaries, Saving Our Sisters. And now I have the pleasure of speaking with her and sitting down with her today. A little bit about Pamela. She has served primarily teens and families, working as a licensed clinical social worker in a variety of settings, including community-based organizations and agencies, residential programs for foster youth, and in schools and in mental health clinics across California. She has been a clinical supervisor for up-and-coming therapists for about 10 years. And in 2017, Pamela had to leave her profession due to a severe disability. And when she returned, so much in the mental health profession had changed, particularly when it comes to the treatment of gender dysphoric patients. In the teen clinic that she was at in California in 2021, 3 out of 10 kids identified as trans. Since she had been in the field with vulnerable youth for over 20 years, this was a very drastic change, and we'll talk more about that today. Pamela has spoken to many therapists who agree that instant affirmation of young people with complex mental health conditions is inappropriate. However, those therapists are being heavily silenced. Pam has been emboldened to speak out on these issues and build her own program, also something we'll chat about today. So Pamela, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for having me. This is great. I appreciate it.
It's great to have professionals like yourself who have so much experience be willing to talk about these issues. And I kind of want to dive right in. You have a unique experience in that you were working as a social worker, had to take a hiatus due to disability, and then you came back to a completely different landscape. So let's talk about that experience and the changes that you saw.
Yeah, it was crazy. So I've been a social worker. I actually got my degree at NYU back in 1997. that's when I graduated in 99, started 97. So I've been around and I've worked in all kinds of settings in New York City and in California. I've worked with foster kids and I've worked in a lot of programs. I landed a lot more with people with mental illness, so people with schizophrenia and bipolar and severe depression. And I worked in group homes, so a lot of attachment trauma type issues, and family therapy schools. That's the other area where I was really working. And I was a clinical supervisor for about 10 years. So I've been around.
And you have so much experience with youth, like, and yes, youth that are being told that they're born in the wrong body specifically.
Well, that honestly, I didn't have that much experience with that before because that wasn't so common in the past, okay, quite frankly. So I was just, but I was very familiar with working with youth who had trauma, people in foster care, people who had child abuse histories, people with other mental health issues in general. And so I work with a lot of kids with behavioral issues and families. And then I've also just worked in general at schools. So throughout the peninsula, which is in California, in the Bay Area, in Silicon Valley area, I was working as a supervisor, overseeing other therapists, working in the schools, working with kids throughout the whole area, like spanning about like 10 schools. I was doing that. And there were actually very little trans youth that time. I stopped working with my disability the end of 2016 or 2017, actually. And then I popped back in just a little bit, tried to get back to work in 2018. I worked for, I'm not sure, about 6 months then, and then I had to drop out again. But even in 2018, that's when I think things were starting to grow with this, but it still wasn't that bad the way it is now. It wasn't as pervasive. There just weren't as many kids. And so I was working all these schools and people weren't keeping secrets from families. People were working collaboratively with parents. That was what I was teaching the interns to do. It was just a whole different world. And then I came back at, just as a per diem, which means basically I was just filling in shifts. I was working 2 days a week, mostly at a IOP PHP program, which is it's individualized outpatient program, partial hospitalization program. And that's basically a group therapy program for people who have usually a mental health issue that had landed them in the hospital and they're transitioning back outside from the hospital. And it's usually, it's sort of like a stepping stone from coming out from some kind of serious mental health issue. So I was doing that in, that was in 2021. Mm-hmm. And that's where I saw the shock because okay. I was actually working there. I had the contrast right there. I was working with adults and kids and the teens. At that program, I was working more with the teens because they needed more help with the teens, yeah. And because I happened to have more experience and be good with the teens, so they kept putting me there.
So what were you seeing, like when you went back? What was so drastically different?
Yeah. So, oh my gosh, like you said in the intro, 3 out of 10 kids were usually non-binary, trans identified in some shape or form. At this time in 2021, at this program, they were all girls. I think it's changing. I think more boys are getting involved in this. So maybe if I were back now that I'd be seeing some boys, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But at the time it was all girls. And so basically it was half the girls actually. So 3 out of 10 out of the total kids, half the girls were non-binary. And I think the most shocking part about it was not just that the girls were saying this, doing this, but it was my colleagues and how they were reacting to it, which was really strange to me, that they just were completely ignoring all of the very obvious issues that were there. Mm-hmm. There were kids that were, it was seriously obvious that they were using it for some other purpose. They were having other issues. Like they were struggling with
health issues, social issues.
Yeah. They were struggling with something. Usually, I mean, these are kids that were having mental health problems. They had just come out of the hospital usually for a depression or a suicide attempt or something like that. And they were feeling really out of control in their lives. Mm-hmm. And then they were using these new identities to kind of gain control of their life, to, in a way, to avoid things. They even some of the kids were talking about how they were conflicted about it. And the adults weren't kind of gravitating towards that to explore it, be like, well, why are you conflicted about that? Or what, you know, what's happening? There was this one girl in particular that I still remember who she was very insightful. She was only 12, I believe. And she had a lot of self-harm. She was cutting. She said she had sexual trauma. I wasn't working with her one-on-one to know her entire background, but she had trauma. She said she really appreciated her parents and said her parents were really loving, but in the same breath she would say they were transphobic because they weren't using her pronouns properly. She said her mom would try, but then behind her back would be using her dead name. And then her dad wasn't doing it, and she said her dad was transphobic and a bigot. But then she would say in the same moment that her dad was a good dad. Those were her words. She'd say he's a good dad. And so clearly there was a disconnect there, right? I felt like she was really grasping for someone to explore with her. What is this? What's happening? And, you know, she couldn't make sense of it. And the therapists weren't doing that with her. I did that with her in the groups I was working with, but I was only working with her in a group setting. So I wasn't doing one-on-one therapy with her. So I couldn't do, I think, the work that was necessary.
Why do you think, so you're not the first person that I've spoken with, both on Venus Rising and not, that talk about how medical professionals, mental health professionals aren't doing the work of kind of helping teens explore what's going on. Rather, they're pushing them towards accepting medical treatment for, and I put that in quotes for those listening, for this dysphoria that they have. Why do you think that?
Well, I mean, now I have a lot of insights on it, but I have to tell you, at the time, I was fresh to all this and I was dumbfounded. I was like, what the heck is going on? I mean, this is so strange. What I was observing there at the time, I'll speak from my naive place and then I'll talk more about, since I've learned a little more about the climate. I just watched them really tiptoe around everything and be really nervous about being looked at as politically incorrect. There was a lot of that. We were in the meetings. We had meetings every day where we would go over the new intakes and talk about the cases, you know, what's happening new with the kids. And they, even when the kids weren't present, they had to use the proper pronoun. In fact, that was one of the first things, what's their pronoun on the chart. And I was like, what? That's the most important thing we're talking about here.
Not that they've been, you know, a victim of sexual trauma or, you know,
wow. Exactly. So, and I was very new and I was part-time, just per diem. Mm-hmm. I had been out on disability. So I felt like I had to get my feet wet again. So I didn't feel comfortable just jumping in and being like, what's going on here?
Right.
But I did say things a little bit here and there, and people would either ignore me or just kind of did not know what to say. So I think it looked like to me, and I'm just going to, I don't even want to knock these individuals I was working with because I actually really like them.
Right.
And they, aside from what I'm describing right now, in general, a lot of them were really skilled and did some good therapy. They weren't all bad. So
I think generally, right, speaking, people go into medicine, therapy, social work, the gamut, because they want to help people. Like, that's the goal. And so when we talk about medical professionals who are failing the system, like, I also don't want to be so hard. We just need to look at this more clearly. But yeah, we have to recognize that something's going wrong. But generally, I think they want to help people, right? So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They definitely wanted to help. But I think there's this desperate need for people. And I think it just brings, my profession brings about this temperament of people who want to be seen as, by others, and I think by themselves, as good people, as someone that's not rude or disrespectful or offensive. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been weaponized against my profession, against people in my field so hard that's where we've landed.
Yeah.
So I was watching that happen in real time. It was really strange. And honestly, I was kind of participating in it too, but weirdly, like I was like, well, what? And they, you know, I remember being really awkward about it, mm-hmm. or avoiding the pronoun altogether and really trying to just de-emphasize it. Right. That's what I think, that's how I was handling it at the time. Mm. But yeah, I also now I'm more, really much more aware of how much censorship has been happening. Those that have tried to speak out really have gotten canceled. They've either been ostracized by their colleagues or lost their job altogether. When I was working there, I read that book by Abigail Schreier, you know, Irreversible Damages. And she wrote there about people through those years that I was on disability, how many people of my colleagues or people in the psychology world had been canceled, both in the academia and in the clinical realm, how they just lost their jobs, how they're completely shunned. And mm-hmm. that was all shocking to me. I didn't know just how pervasive the cancel culture was. Anybody who just said something to the effect of, we just need to figure out what's happening with this individual, out, you know, I was like, oh, so that's why we've landed mm-hmm. here. People have been weeded. They're being weeded out. They have been weeded out for quite a while. And I wasn't aware of that. So that was happening. I think that was a big, big part of it. And then now I'm in California. We're both in California. There's a lot of laws that are stopping people from being able to do their jobs. At the time, even to 2021, those laws weren't in effect, but we were headed there. But now people are so scared to do anything because they'll lose their license. And those with ethics, they're avoiding working with kids. You know, those that are aware of what's going on, that have the same insight I do, they're just say that I won't work with kids. And so I just think there's so many angles here. It's definitely coming from top down.
It's heartbreaking too, because also in California, we're having a hard time, you know, having, you know, I called the primary care and they're busy or I can't get a doctor. And the same is true for mental health professionals. And so it's really heartbreaking to hear so many leaving the profession because of this, because, you know, but can you talk a little bit more about the laws and the changes specifically? So people know, I feel like I tell people what's happening here, or I tell them about how in schools, because you've worked in the school setting, how parents are being completely, you know, removed from the conversation and things are hidden from them and people don't believe me sometimes. So can you speak a little bit more to that?
Yeah. So again, these are the shocking things, because when I was working in the schools just 4 or 5 years ago, this wasn't happening. Maybe it was, but not to the degree it is now. But yeah, what's happening in the schools is the counselors are being trained to basically trans the kids behind the parents' backs. I mean, they're not just doing it because they think it's clinically right or something like that. They're actually being trained top down to do this. And if they don't, they get in trouble. That's what's, to me, so insane. It's not just that, oh, well, they have these rogue therapists or these virtue signaling therapists, or whatever you want to call it, that think this is the right thing and they're doing it. I mean, maybe that's how it was in some points, but now it's coming from top down, the administrations, the CDC. Is it the CDC? One of the big bodies. I think they just put out a whole guidelines for schools to trans kids and to use all the pronouns. And yeah, they're keeping secrets from parents. And that's the other big shocking piece, because my entire training, and I come from a pretty, I'd say, liberal or left-leaning background. I went to NYU. I actually did a full year family therapy training in Berkeley, California, where we were learning how to connect families. I mean, so even like what was previously liberal minded is being completely eradicated about splitting up families. So that, yeah, so they're splitting up families, and it's wild to me, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's being enforced as rules, not just as a culture. Mm-hmm. So it's both cultural and a rule.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was the CDC. I think you are correct on that citation there. I have talked recently with someone, and for those that don't know, our film, The Detransition Diaries, is coming out as a book. Yay. We are in the editing process now, and I talk about this in the book, about the role of ACEs and advanced childhood, or not advanced, goodness, I can't even talk, adverse childhood events. And you talked a little bit about trauma. When you see the numbers, 3 out of 10, all the girls in the program declaring that they're non-binary, of course, everyone in that cohort obviously had some sort of mental instability or something that put them in the hospital, and they're working backwards. But what do you think the occurrence is then of kids who have these ACEs or traumatic events who are now identifying or saying that they were born in the wrong body? What is there a connection there?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think it's changing in terms of the degree, because now it's becoming so trendy, and it's being pushed so hard from every angle, right? From the schools and Hollywood and TV, on social media. We know the internet is a huge influence, and the social contagion is so strong. The social influence is so strong. Mm-hmm. So I think there are some people that are getting sort of sucked into this that don't have serious trauma or don't have serious mental health issues. But I think they're probably easier to get pulled out of it because they don't have other things that really made them feel so strongly that this was a new identity that would help them.
Mm-hmm.
But the wave of detransitioners that we're seeing now, especially those three women that you did that film on, the time period that they got into it, I think from what I understand, every single person I've talked to in person on the internet or just seen videos and interviews on, every single person has had some underlying mental health issue. Usually it is trauma. Sometimes it's more around autism or a really strong grief reaction sometimes. Mm-hmm. There's so many different situations. There's no one. I think we see patterns, but there really is no one size fits all. I think a lot of people have different situations that will end up make them believe that this is going to help them. I mean, what I say the general trend is that someone's having some kind of suffering, whatever that is, and they see the trans identity as a way out of the suffering that they're having. And they're given a lot of false promises. So it makes sense that they would gravitate towards that.
Yeah. Which is all the more reason why a comprehensive evaluation and approach would be helpful, right?
Yeah.
sounds like if there's so much going on and we're not sure exactly how to pinpoint it and it's no one size fits all, then we more than ever need to really be slow and methodical and evaluate what's going on in this child's life or teenager's life or young adult's life.
Yeah, it's really strange to me. I'll just tell you, as a therapist, this 180, because honestly, therapists used to be really annoying about how much they'd analyze things, right? they wouldn't jump to conclusions. Our whole profession is based on analyzing, like what's really going on, right? The unconscious. I mean, we're supposed to not look at things for face value. We're always supposed to look at what's happening underneath the surface. And for them to just ignore that entire philosophy completely is mind-boggling to me.
Yeah.
Sometimes I used to think, come on, you know, the person's just hungry, give them a snack and then they won't be so cranky. Let's stop with the therapy. You know, like sometimes it was that simple, but sometimes now it's
a physical need. Yeah.
But now with this gender issue, we're ignoring everything. Yeah. It's just usually so obvious. There's something going on. The person doesn't feel like they fit in. They don't feel comfortable in their body. They're having, you know, eating disorder issues. I mean, if they have some kind of self-harm, I mean, right there, that's something to explore. Why are they self-harming themselves? Mm-hmm. I just don't understand how we could jump to this conclusion. I mean, as you know, and it's mentioned even in your film, I mean, 30-minute consultation, you can get hormones? That's bizarre that's okay. I think that should be illegal.
Right. Well, we're just jumping to medical treatment. I mean, in any other aspect, we want to say, okay, you know, for example, you have high blood pressure. It's oftentimes, okay, well, let's fix the high blood pressure. Let's exercise more. Let's eat better diet. Then let's talk about medication. Or if you're on medication, how can we get you off of this? How can we unmedicalize you? Whereas this is something completely different where we're medicalizing as fast as we can.
Yeah, it's wild. And as you're talking, I was just thinking about my personal experience. So as you said earlier, I was on disability for several years. And part of what kept me on disability for so long is because doctors didn't believe me. They were somaticizing my physical issues. They just kept saying I was anxious and I was avoiding life. I was in severe nerve pain, but because what was happening to me wasn't showing up on the typical tests, they didn't believe me. And they put me on antidepressants instantly. Mm-hmm. And they didn't help me, obviously, because it wasn't about depression. It was about a physical issue. And so here I was being told I was having all these psychological issues and I need to just handle my psychological issues. But I really had a very serious physical issue. It was a rare disorder called thoracic outlet syndrome, where my nerves were being crushed over here. And it was terrible. Right. But all the doctors, they all thought they were professional therapists and were giving me therapy. I mean, I even had doctors literally giving me cognitive behavioral therapy in their offices. Meanwhile, they weren't addressing the fact that I actually have a medical issue.
Yeah, it's a great example. So we've talked a lot about how we are responding, but how, in your opinion, should therapists or mental health professionals be responding to this? And what would you like to see?
Well, I think the obvious is I think we need to treat people as whole human beings. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Typically, as a therapist, like I said earlier, we do a full assessment. And what that involves is finding out all the different aspects of what's happening with that person. You talk to their families. You talk, oftentimes, if we're talking with kids, we even can talk to their teachers. We can talk to people in their lives. We're like detectives where we find out what's going on so we can explore and find out what's happening. And now with the gender issue, none of that is happening. There is no exploration. There's just instant affirming. Mm-hmm. So I think that we need to explore. I do think probably some people might disagree with this who are really, I guess, pure about this. It is difficult to just instantly say to a person who's identifying as trans, no, you're not. You need the truth. This is what you are, right? Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes that can just push them further away from you and there's backlash. So I don't think it's helpful to just throw the truth at the person right away, but to work with them to help them get ready to hear the truth and to learn about where they're coming from and why they're believing this. Mm-hmm. So,
or discover the truth themselves. I think, you know,
exactly. Kind of like that girl I described earlier, I feel like she was primed to get there. If I were her individual therapist, that's what I would have been doing. Mm-hmm. Exploring with her. Why, you know, what are the good parts about her parents? Why would they not want to believe her? Explore with her what happened to her. What, you know, when did she decide she was non-binary and what did she get out of it? And, you know, what would happen if she wasn't? Just all these different things. And just explore her individual issues. What her relationship with her body, which is probably really not good, you know, difficult. Just all the things that a therapist does, explore.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I would be doing. Yeah.
Yeah. So talk to me then about, it's a great segue, about the program that you're building. Why is it needed, your program? What is your vision?
So, yeah. So because I can't work full time, I can't do full time therapy anymore because I still do have chronic pain. Mm-hmm. And I was taken out of my job, unfortunately, because of the California mandates, and I made a personal decision. I decided that was my time first to speak up and be the voice for a lot of other people that agree with me, but can't because of this cancel culture. And then, yeah, I built this program called The Parent's Guide to Mental Health because I saw the mental health system be so radically different from all the years I worked as a supervisor. All this training I had, I felt like was being erased. And I wanted to basically put out my knowledge that I have to the universe, and mainly for parents, but it doesn't necessarily have to be for parents, on what is appropriate mental health care.
Mm.
And I actually built some online classes. I built 10 online classes, actually 11. I just added a new one.
Awesome.
11 online classes on all different topics. And gender dysphoria is one of them. It's obviously the big hot topic, but the way I see it is actually a symptom of a bigger problem. I just see how the mental health system is being kind of corrupted. Mm-hmm. And that's just sort of the symptom of it, where we're not seeing therapists do thorough assessments anymore. We're not seeing therapists involve families anymore. We're not seeing, we're seeing therapists display a lot of red flags, not having appropriate boundaries with their clients, where they're using their clients for their own egos, that sort of thing. Disclosing too much. I'm, you know, there's always discussion about what's appropriate self-disclosure, but when you're disclosing so much that it's no longer about your patient, that's inappropriate. Mm-hmm. So just, I've put out a lot of information, a lot about what my training is and my experience, so that the parents are emboldened to know what's okay. Because I think when you're in crisis and your family is struggling, you feel uneasy, like, you know, something's not right, but you don't know what it is and you don't know what to confront. And so I wanted to put out there that information, like give the language, you know, what, just therapy words, so they can say to this therapist, this isn't kosher, I don't feel this is right, and this is why. Mm. You know, and you read what I write, and you read like questions you can ask your therapist about what they're doing with your child, or even how to screen for an appropriate therapist, so that you can actually have the language. Mm. And be the best advocate for your child and your family and for yourself.
That sounds like such a great resource because, like you said, you know, if something comes up, maybe it's the first time these parents or families are having to need a therapist or need help, and you don't know what to expect. I mean, we just had a baby and we're using a pediatrician now. And even that, it's like, okay, I'm in the medical community. I'm a nurse, and how even intimidating it can be, like, just to find a pediatrician and what kind of questions you should ask. And so I imagine that parents who have a child who's struggling and they see their child hurting, they need to know that they're seeing a competent health professional. And I think that sounds like a great kind of guide to answer some initial questions and help them really. I'm thinking of Brynn too in our film, Transmission, What's Thrust to Reassign Gender, and how she had to really advocate for her daughter to find a pediatrician that wouldn't just affirm her, and, you know, I'm thinking of professionals who say, you know, would you rather have a live son or a dead daughter? And how that's like really malpractice, right? Like, yeah, that's not okay.
I have a whole section on that, actually.
That's not okay. Mm-hmm. So yeah, anyway, I'll let you continue. Sorry.
Yeah. So sorry, I interrupted. See, I have a whole section on that. And some of it I actually put on my social media, on my Instagram, which is The Truthful Therapist. But I go into more detail in my lessons about things you can ask the therapist about if they start to basically tell that lie, because it's a lie. And the first thing to do, I think when you're in that moment, you're blackmailed. You're like, you know, yeah. If you don't know, you think an expert's telling you this, you think, oh my gosh, this is what I have to do. I just listened to an interview with Chloe Cole, who's been very outspoken, and she said that's exactly what happened to her parents, and that's how they were persuaded to go along with this gender medicine. But yeah, the very first question I put out there for the parents to ask is, why don't you ask them about what studies they're referencing, and see what they tell you. mm-hmm. what they actually present to you. Because what happens is they're just parroting these things, but they've never actually looked at the studies themselves. I mean, I've seen those trainings. They don't even give you the they don't even give you the studies. They just say it. I mean, they just say these things empty, and then people just take it at face value. So be like, okay, can I see the studies? There are these fake studies out there, but they've all been redacted and none of them prove anything because they have very small sample sizes and they don't actually follow a population long enough because we don't have the long-term data. The only long-term study is that one from Sweden from like 2000 that ended in 2003.
The Destiny study, is that the one you're thinking about?
I'm not sure what it's called. It's like from 1973 to 2003. Mm-hmm. Where they study, and it's adults.
Yeah, suicide risk was actually higher after.
Higher in the end. Yeah, after gender assignment surgery, yeah. That's the only one that really shows anything. But it's actually, that one's sort of outdated, and it doesn't really reflect today's climate, especially mm-hmm. with youth.
Right.
So we really don't have the data at all. So that's just one thing to push back on. Well, show me the data. I actually talked to a parent, and I had her do that at a gender clinic. And first she said they just didn't respond. It took them several weeks to respond. And then when they did finally respond, they showed her this study that just showed these questions that didn't prove anything. The questions actually just asked the child if they've ever felt suicidal, which is very common for someone who's seeking mental health treatment to have ever felt suicidal, not that they are suicidal. And then it doesn't prove anything about whether if they're affirmed or not, if that changes the outcome. Mm-hmm. So that's the other thing. So yes, we have a population who tends to be more suicidal because, as we were just saying earlier, there usually are other mental health issues. The three women in Detransition Diaries, I think they all, I don't know if they felt suicidal or not, but they all had mental health issues that were going unaddressed. And so that makes them more vulnerable to suicidality. So I think that's why it's easy to weaponize this. But you got to use a little bit of critical thinking and realize that, well, is it the gender or affirming the gender that's going to alleviate this suicidality? Or is it addressing the mental health issue or maybe the family issue or the eating disorder issue or whatever the issue, the trauma, addressing that, is that going to alleviate the suicide? And it doesn't happen quickly. Nothing does. Yes. So,
yeah. Well, and I can imagine in that situation too, parents do want, you know, they want to relieve their kids suffering. What parent wants to see their kids suffering and struggling? And with the polarization of the media and this on this topic, it can be so overwhelming. So appreciate your willingness to be a little bit of a renegade and really help parents with that program. Is that something that you will continue to add classes to and continue to build? What's your long-term vision for this?
So yeah, it's ongoing. So it's $5 a month right now. And I just added a new class. Basically, it's about how and why parents should be involved in therapy specifically so that you can confront the clinician about why they're not talking to you about your kid.
Yeah.
So you have specific things like, for example, like you need to talk to a parent to know what was the developmental history of your child. A child doesn't know all. They don't know what they were doing when they were a toddler, when they started walking and talking. Those are things that are very important for a clinician to know mm-hmm. when they're working with somebody. So that's just one example. So so I'll be adding content. I have lots of ideas. They're all in the works. I've also been doing a Substack to supplement it, which is Pam, the Truthful Therapist. And yeah, my goal is to basically get that information out to parents. I am going to be offering consultations. So if a parent is either looking for a therapist or really my vision was if you're working with a therapist and you weren't sure about what they were doing, you could talk to me about what they're doing. And I'm not even talking about like specifically the clinical issues, but just the approaches. And I could say, well, actually, it sounds like they're avoiding this very glaring issue in your family. Sure. Or I actually did a consultation with a parent and she said, well, we just want our kid to be happy. We're trying to get her to be happy. And I told her about how, you know, sometimes therapy isn't about being happy. It's actually about facing the pain. Mm-hmm. And that's how you to work through it. And a therapist should be helping that child be able to cope with their pain so that they can, you know, obviously land being happy or find happiness and feel joy, but just being happy is really not the goal. It's unrealistic. No one can just be happy. So like helping them understand what therapy can do and what it does, just ideas like that. And yeah, just giving them that insight on what it is.
Yeah, that's really, I think that's an incredible resource. Can you do consultations outside of the state of California? Would this be open to, or are you, because I don't know if there's limitations as far as like licensing and stuff, but would that?
Yeah, I don't need my license. That's what's so great about the fact that I'm stepping up is with what I'm doing. I have a license. I clearly have a lot of experience.
Yes.
I'm caught up on my CEUs, which really are lame here in California anyway, but I've done all the legwork for it. I have the credentials, but if something terrible would happen and someone were to threaten me to take away my license, it's really not a big threat because I'm not doing the actual direct clinical work. What sure. I'm doing is I'm helping them find someone who will do the clinical work. Like my goal is not actually to do therapy with your family. My goal is to help you find a therapist that will do appropriate therapy with your family. So wow. Yeah, it can be anywhere. I mean, even internationally, quite frankly.
Yeah, that sounds great. And your resource for $5 a month, that's so minimal considering what's at stake here. And I think, like you've talked about, you have so much. I can't speak to Pamela enough as far as I love that I get to know her and get to see her at events. And for anyone listening, you know, she has a great deal of experience. Like you said, you've studied at Berkeley, you've been in New York. So I do think her program is worth it. And she is an asset to this conversation. So appreciate that. So we'll kind of wrap up with a couple of more questions, but I like to ask everyone I have on the show regarding this issue, do you have hope for the future? Do you see tides changing? What do you think?
Yeah, for sure. You know, so I know that a lot of people have been in this fight for a long time. Mm-hmm. I've only really been public. When did I start? It'll be almost a year where I've been public on this issue. And so much has changed since then. I mean, both it's gotten more radical, I'd say, on the left, but at the same time, so many more people are aware of this issue and so many more people are interested in hearing about it. It's completely changed that so many more media outlets, I mean, not the real mainstream ones, but a lot of media outlets are talking about it. The detransitioners, they have really found a voice. They have found a community. That was not the case, even just a year ago, but definitely 2 years ago. So the fact that so many people are talking about it and so many people are interested in it. I mean, before, if I had said to someone this was happening, they would think I was crazy. Now people are... They come up to me and they start telling me about it. I'm like, yeah, I know.
but that's living great. This.
Like, I know I've been talking about it for a while. But the thing is that it's great, you know, because they just hear about it. But you know what? That's great because the word is getting out. It's becoming a more mainstream where people are recognizing this is a problem. And it's a problem. This isn't, I mean, they've made it a political issue, but it people across the political spectrum see this as a problem. Mm-hmm. Caring about kids. I'd say just having common sense about what we were just saying earlier. I don't think you need a therapy degree to recognize that you need to explore issues before you start doing drastic medical interventions on someone that isn't required. So I think people are seeing the common sense and they're talking about it. People mm-hmm. are talking about it among themselves. I think the tide is turning. I think it's going to take a while because the people who are invested in this, the higher ups, they're invested in it. So they're pushing harder. So yeah. There's more conflict. It feels, in a way, it feels worse because there's more conflict. There's more of a clash, but that's because more of us are speaking out, right? And there's mm-hmm. more films like yours coming out. It's just a lot more talk. So I think it will turn around. Unfortunately, I believe there's going to be some more collateral damage in the process, but I don't know what the timeline is, but I could see in 5 years, things being very different than they are right now.
I hope so. I hope so for these kids' sake, you know, it breaks my heart to hear. And like you said, and I can't reiterate this enough, like, because of the work I do and the work you do, we see this. And when we tell people, they're kind of like, that's not happening. No way, you know, and then they hear the stories and unfortunately it has to happen personally or within their sphere. And we just really want to keep kids safe, like bottom line. Right.
Yeah. It's hitting more families. I think that's the other reason, you know, people who just think, well, that's happened to those people. And then their daughter who's always been girly their whole life, or maybe their daughter who's just been a little shy, but this hasn't been an issue, suddenly won't talk to them because of this. They're like, oh, wait a second. Maybe this, maybe it's not about being transphobic after all. Maybe there's more to this. Mm-hmm. So people are seeing it firsthand.
So my last question then is, what can parents do? Let's say we have some parents listening, and what's like their first step? Their kid is telling them they're born in the wrong body, or they're changing their pronouns, they're declaring themselves non-binary. What is a parent's should be first step?
Well, if possible, take away their social media and their phones.
Okay. Get outside.
Yeah. I know that's not easy, but usually that really fixes things very quickly. A lot of it comes from that. Also, it depends on how deep they're in it already. You know, there's kids that have been quietly deepening themselves in it for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be harder to have a conversation with them because they feel really, you know, embedded in it and really identify with it. And they feel like they found their new family and all that. And that's what makes it so hard. It's the division of families to me. That's one of the saddest pieces of all this. And that's what makes it so challenging. If you can, that you talk to your child about what's going on, just ask them basic open-ended questions. But I would try to do it in a way that's not confrontational and not saying there are only two genders and start yelling that at them, or start saying, you're a girl, like, stop it already. And because that, unfortunately, I think that will push them further away from you if they're getting into it.
Sure.
But the best you can, figure out what are the influences on your child, whether it be the friend group or the school, and try your best to remove them from it and find a good therapist, one that's not going to just affirm. And really, it's probably about your family. Like, I'm not about blaming people, but it's that's not the point. It's about just figuring out what's happening in your family, figuring out what is your child missing. Maybe they need more attention. Maybe everyone's been distracted. Maybe they've had a hard time during the lockdowns, and this is one way they're manifesting it. Maybe they don't feel comfortable with their friends, and they found a new friend and they feel good about themselves for the first time. So it's really about figuring out what's going on with your child. Mm-hmm. And being present with your child. And, you know, you probably might need a therapist to figure that out.
Yeah. And it's not bad, right? Like, therapy is great, and relationships are messy, and life is messy, and it's complicated. And sometimes you just need an external perspective to help you kind of get through the weeds. So I'm a big advocate for therapy if it's needed, or just in general. Anyway, Pamela, I want to thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show. And I look forward to seeing you at events around the Bay Area in the future. But thank you for caring so much about families and the families that you will serve. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I wanted to add one more thing about
Absolutely.
Advice.
Absolutely.
So there are a lot of parents and families that are going through this. And I really advise seeking those out. Other parents who've been through it, because I think they're actually maybe in a way the best advisors they have learned tricks to the trade to how to get through to the children.
Yeah.
I think that's where I've actually learned the most from, is other parents who have been in it, have pulled their children out of it, or still even in the thick of it. So finding other parents, there is a website called Parents of ROGD Kids and .com. And that's one really good resource. There's also a Substack called Pit Parents, I believe, Parents of Inconvenienced Truths About Trans. And so they have really good resource. And then, of course, my course might be really helpful.
Yes,
I have
of course.
One specifically on gender dysphoria. So yeah, seeking out information.
Yeah, I think that's great advice, is to kind of finding, just like you said, the folks who are having to detransition and go through this, they've kind of found support within their group. And so parents finding support with other parents who've walked this and have been doing, I know a few personally that they're involved in those groups that Pamela just talked about. So yeah, I think finding like-minded individuals or just others who have experienced and it's okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, yes, that's great. Thank you again. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you for serving families. I can't say thank you enough, Pamela.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. Thanks for allowing me to have a voice.
Yes. And I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in. I hope that you walk away from today's conversation empowered, emboldened, enlightened, encouraged. And even though our conversation with Pam is over, you can find and follow her on Instagram at The Truthful Therapist, on Twitter at red pill LCSW. I hope I got, did I get that right?
Yeah, those are my credentials. So I'm a licensed clinical social worker. So LCSW. Yeah.
Red pilled, PILLED LCSW. And you can find her on Substack at pamthetruthfultherapist.substack.com. And on her website, where you can also find her program, at www.thetruthfultherapist.org. And I will include all of those links in our little description so you can find them and you don't have to quickly write them down. But again, thank you for listening, and may you always think critically and think beyond the masses.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.